Managing Violence Podcast, episode 92. We're talking to Temiyard McCracken, a psychotherapist's view on self-defense, personal safety, and the realities of self-protection for women. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. We're going back to our roots today. We're talking about real self-defense, self-protection skills. And my guest today is Temiyard McCracken. Temi is just brilliant. She's so smart. She's so switched on. And she has a really unique take on self-protection, especially in the women's context, because she wasn't a martial artist who then evolved her skill set. Rather, she was a therapist who sought out self-defense training to be able to assist her clients with a level of surety, prevention, confidence, etc. So her take on martial arts is very different. Her take on self-protection skills is quite different and presents a really mature understanding of the subject matter. So it was a really fascinating conversation. Please make sure you do check out our sponsors, Fuji Sports. If you go to one of the links in the comments or in the show description below, you'll see the links to both the US and the Australian sites. If you put in the coupon code MVP10, you can get 10% off any purchase there, with a few exceptions, but 10% off nearly everything that Fuji Sports offers. Highest quality judo gis, BJJ gis, fight gear, etc., etc. If you're after something martial arts related, you can probably get it at Fuji and it'll be really top quality. I personally use their gear and that's why I endorse them. So make sure you head over to Fuji and put in MVP10 for 10% off. Also, if you were interested in getting a free signed copy of my book, Neon Jungle, A Bouncer's True Tales of Lessons, Laughs, and Lacerations, which covers the highlights of my life leading up to my career on the Doors and then some of the great stories that happened while I was working the Doors, then I'm going to be giving away two free signed copies to listeners of the show. Now, to qualify, here's what you need to do. There are two options. Option A. Leave a review on your podcast platform of choice, so iTunes or Apple Podcasts would be now, Google Podcasts, whatever you are currently using to listen to this show. Leave a review there. Screenshot that review and then post it in the Managing Violence Tribe Facebook group, which I'll link in the show notes if you're not already a member, and use the hashtag MVPReview, #MVPReview. That's option A. So leave a review on your podcast platform, take a screenshot, share it in the group, MVPReview. Option B. If your podcast platform doesn't allow you to leave reviews because there's a couple out there that make it difficult, then leave a review on the Managing Violence Facebook page. Again, I'll put the link in the show notes. Screenshot that review and then post it again with hashtag MVPReview. At the end of July, so the end of this month, I'll be randomly selecting two names that left reviews and I'll reach out to you guys to get your postal addresses and I will be sending you a free copy of Neon Jungle, A Bouncer's True Tales of Lessons, Laughs, and Lacerations. Personally signed by me, and yeah, I'll even cover the postage wherever you are in the world because what's the point of a giveaway if you have to pay for postage? So we'll cover that. It's on the house. So if you'd like a free copy, make sure you check that out. Leave us a review, share it, and a hashtag appropriately so we can find it. All right. Without further ado, we are going to get into the podcast. Please remember, as always, if you're after bonus content from this episode from Tammy or any of our previous guests, head on over to patreon.com/managingviolence and you will find for as little as $5 a month a whole bunch of bonus content, which is more than worth the price of admission. That's it. Let's get to Tammy. Here we go. Temiyard McCracken. I'm joined here on the Managing Violence podcast by Temiyard McCracken. Tammy, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's always fun to get to talk to other people in the industry.
Absolutely. Now, you've been name dropped by a number of guests in the past. In particular, Randy King is a big fan of your work. You're someone that I've seen others that I really respect in the industry share and speak highly of. So it's exciting to finally get you on the show. Tammy, for those that don't know anything about you, could you quickly sort of give us, I guess, the summary of your story of how you got to where you are and what you currently do?
Yeah, I'll try to keep it short. It's a weird story. So
I love those. Those are my favorites.
It's definitely not a straight line. So we're kind of working backwards. 500 Rising is an evolution of things that I learned along the way of being an instructor with Krav Maga and running a gym in the Northern Virginia area. But how I got into martial arts and Krav Maga in particular was a byproduct of my years working as a psychotherapist and working over time. The universe sort of decides your specialty for you by how certain clients get driven to your work, and ended up doing a tremendous amount of work with individuals who'd been through horrific events. And it ranging from severe child abuse to people who'd been shot to, you know, varying levels of type of violent experiences. And I reached a point towards the latter years that I was in practice in Texas. So we moved across the country about 11 years ago, and where it became internally somewhat frustrating that I started to hear the same consistent types of stories over time from individuals, and women in particular, who had been survivors of violent encounters. And the way the stories unfold, there's this whole timeline of, you know, if there was a way that we could have some form of information sharing or education or something on the prevention side, I'd love to be put out of business as a shrink on that side. You know, like, it'd be really nice if there was a way that we could stop having to do so much aftermath intervention with so many people so consistently. And I started nosing around, and that there's a protracted story, but the short version is I landed in Krav Maga as a martial art to become an instructor in. And with any combat fighting system, if one is paying attention to your training and to realities of violence, there you'll find these little gaps and holes and inconsistencies in application. And so then I started digging in again to fill that and find the rest of the information and how to integrate that in. And being a female in a largely, like you say, male dominated profession, then I also started to notice and hearing from female colleagues in combat arts that there were these additional chunks missing or addressed kind of sideways as far as like its usefulness and application. And yet again, wouldn't it be nice if there was something that really specifically addressed the realities of violence in women? And then there was a Oprah Winfrey, who I love to hear her speak because she's so eloquent and so poised, and she won a Lifetime Achievement Award some years ago. And in her acceptance speech was giving a nod to, at the time, the exploding hashtag MeToo movement. And all, it's certainly, I think, done a huge amount for awareness, to be sure. I had a moment of frustration. Here's the other creature in my universe, is the feline, who's been at the other end of the table until now. Of course, we got an ear in there.
for those who listen to the audio, there was a cat's ear that suddenly just photobombed the Tabby screen.
Yeah, sorry about that. There was a frustration in listening to this because my concern was that all of the energy would get anchored into awareness of the statistics, which is what I think Me Too certainly has done. And that somehow was going to be what created change. And in addition to working with survivors of violence, I've also worked with perpetrators of violent action, and have enough insight and have done enough research into that, that just awareness is not going to stop those guys. You know, if it was, it already wouldn't be an issue. So I had a moment of frustration in listening to that and, you know, like, oh, don't, like, everybody listening, please don't take that as the sum total. And because we have this Me Too movement going on, things are going to magically, statistically improve dramatically. In my frustration, I wrote a kind of a snarky blog. And a good friend of mine was like, oh, that was great. And you should do this thing. And the blog was, give me 500, give me 500 women that we can train up to deliver effective, easily transmittable prevention, situational awareness, threat assessment, physical skills, and they can go out and teach in their communities. And there will be women who will come up and want to teach out of that. And then eventually we'll get a statistical tipping point where the threat who's assessing out there, like who is going to be my low risk, high reward target, starts to realize that the majority of women that they may be targeting are high risk, low reward, then we see the numbers change. So this was my snarky little blog. And a friend of mine was like, you should do this. I'm like, no. And she's like, no, really, you should do this. And her name is Allie DiRienzo. She runs Wolf Dog Marketing and has been instrumental in the development of 500 Rising because she was a dog with a bone. And 2 years later, she's like, no, I'm kind of tired of knocking on your door for this. When are you going to do this? So, and that's how we got here.
I love that because when I first saw the hashtag 500 Rising, I thought that's a cool hashtag, but I had no idea what the origin of it was. Like, I mean, I kind of assumed based on what the content was, I mean, what you're trying to do, but that's a cool origin story. And I love that you've started looking at it from a trauma point of view and then added the martial arts rather than like most of us that eventually end up looking at the psychology of violence, myself included, we start off as martial artists and then try to fill in the gaps of the behavioral cues. So that's something that is really interesting to me that you've actually gone the opposite way. And I don't know if you've come across Ellis Amdo before, but Ellis has been on the podcast a couple of times, incredibly high ranking martial artist, but also a psychotherapist as well and crisis intervention specialist. And he's been on the show a few times. I love talking to Ellis because he's such a wealth of knowledge in that space. You pulled on something right at the beginning of your story that I'd love to just unpack a little bit. And that was dealing with victims of trauma. And it's a discussion I actually just had with Ron Amram on a show that will probably come out, I think, just before this one, about the ethics of how we market self-defense and how we market martial arts or self-protection skills, and recognizing that most of the people that are coming looking specifically for self-defense, not fight training or martial arts, but for self-defense, are coming from a place of trauma. Most, I mean, if not a legitimate trauma, then at least a fear of trauma, like a conflict fear. So given that, I mean, how important is it in your mind to, I guess, understand the traumas of the people you're teaching, but also if you have dealt with these traumas yourself, to be able to process that fully before, I guess, really engaging the physical skills?
Each one of those sentences/questions is really dense.
I'm just queuing you up to go for the next hour so I can switch off.
Nicely done. Having some understanding of trauma as a concept and how it functions inside of us as human beings and what high impact events do to the individual and how they're processed, I think is essential if you are particularly marketing from a self-defense perspective. Because, and I love the way that you said this, there either has been some historical experience or the client who's seeking this training is still functioning within that frame of reference, but from a concern or a fear or worry. And as an example, a couple of years ago, I had two young women who were just graduating high school here in the US, and somehow they managed to convince their parents. I'm like, you guys need to go into sales, let me tell you. So they'd somehow managed to convince their parents as a graduation gift from high school to travel through the Greek islands by themselves, sort of Ubering and Airbnb-ing it and just kind of randomly moving through a part of the country that is known as one of the places where we see human trafficking uptick. So I'm like, whatever you guys are doing for a living, I hope it's sales, because
your parents didn't watch Taken, did they?
or something. So, but at least the dads were like, all right, if you're going to do this, you have to take some self-defense classes. And so then I get the phone call and there's always that expectation that we can do it in an hour and somehow magically we have everything we need. So good conversation with the dad. And I said, you know, if I'm going to work with them, we're going to do it over several different sessions. And a good portion of that is going to be associated with prevention, threat assessment, blah, 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 versus the physical. And that whole big picture of that is the dad's awareness, the parent's awareness that there's a fear out there of the possibility that this could happen. So let's come at this ahead of time. The girls had lived shielded enough in a privileged enough aspect of society. They were kind of like, this is going to be fun. And And while I have a significant issue with fear-based marketing, I'm not sure, I'm not comfortable with that from an ethics standpoint. At the end of solid education, otherwise unaware young women or women of any age, if they come out going, got it, there are things I need to be paying attention to, then we've done our job, right? So anyway, I love your context around that, that they're coming into self-defense training either because they want to say that's never happening again, or they are conscious of something that could happen and therefore are trying to prevent it. So that's that conversation of fear at the rawest level, I think. And if we're not aware of how fear operates in the body. And so I'm a whole neuropsych nerd, and I know not everybody geeks out on all that stuff. And, you know, so I try to be careful about how excited I get about neurons and synapses and all that. But if the information is out there, we're learning so much more about how our brain functions and that function of what we call the survival stress response and everything that it entails. And so if we don't have even a basic understanding of that, and a little time on the internet will get you started, then teaching self-defense, if I'm going to be super opinionated here, I would say don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think there's significant differences. And this was something that I battled as a young instructor, especially. I mean, I started teaching martial arts as a teenager. I started teaching, I guess, quote unquote, reality-based self-defense when I was like 21, 22. I was working as a bouncer. And to quote Mary Stevens, she said that, yeah, a lot of self-defense is by bouncers for bouncers. And that was very much my reality, right? I was training other large, physically fit, aggressive alpha males in who are dealing with conflict every single night, who are getting case studies and practice every single night, who are usually not coming from a place of fear, but rather a place of trying to be more efficient or maybe, and look, to be completely honest, an ego-driven place as well, where it was more about being a badass than it was about not having like something horrible, life-changing happen to you. And then I made the mistake of thinking, and it's just more ignorance than anything else, but I made the mistake of thinking, well, this is the same stuff that I need to teach women. and it's completely different. And again, I don't want to lump everyone in the same category. I've trained a lot of women that were alpha, ego driven, chest beating. Like they wanted to get in and train exactly the way I was training these bouncers. But when it came to the people that really needed the training, the people that really needed the help, is so much more detailed than that. And I found that, you know, like some of them, they just needed to sit down and talk. Like it almost needed to be counseling to start with, to sort of unpack what you're looking for out of the training, why you think you need that. Let's test some of your, I guess, misconceptions about what you think training is going to do for you and how, and the skills you're going to get out of it and how long it's going to take. And like, you really need to have those open and honest conversations about someone's motivations to train. And that's not to say if you're running a commercial martial arts studio, you have to do a full intervention before someone starts training, right? You can just get them into a class right. And figure this stuff out as you go. But considering I was doing a lot of private lessons, I really wanted to get to know my students so that I could give them what they needed, not necessarily what they thought they needed. So I'm sure that's something that you deal with a lot.
100%. And I can relate to your conversation about some of the women are coming to train. They want to train like the bouncers do. Cause that's like, one of the reasons why I love and fell in love with Krav Maga is that I want to hit things. It's going to sound so wrong, but I want to take that beating, you know, I want to prove myself in that arena. Absolutely. And so one of the things that we've talked about with our instructor development program is right now, in particular, the people who are coming to us because we're new are people who've heard about this. It's 6 degrees, you know somebody who knows somebody. And in the women who are in the group, which is large right now, we're aiming largely to train women. We're certainly also training men. Our conversation is you have to remember you are not your student. This is the you that is here, the you that is going, wow, I wonder how I got that bruise. I have no idea. Did you see the big handprint on the back of my arm? You know, we're excited. Those are not the students that we'll be reaching generally by and large.
Yeah, accepting that you're not normal is a good starting point.
I am
not most people.
That's right. There's something a little bit wrong with me. And being able to acknowledge that. In fact, I just came back from an instructor training last week and have a woman in the group who I've known just through the martial arts community, not otherwise, for the last 4 years or so. And she's got an abundance of training underneath her and very aware of the distinction between martial arts and self-defense. And yet when she was running some of the physical stuff we were playing with and watching her response, and I've been hammering on like, think as a student, as you play with these physical skills. And she's in, you know, BJJ mode going into like wraps and locks and holds. And I'm like, okay, got it. But that is not what we're, the fallacy is that you're going to teach that in a 2-hour course and it's going to be effective. And then the deeper, unfortunately, I don't know how to frame this, but there's a reality that because of culture and how women are socialized and all of the things on an adult, like graduated from high school, college female's plate, is that she's not likely to be us. She's not likely to come train for 2 years. So if we're teaching a very complex physical skill that she needs to rep multiple times, and we know she's not coming back, you know? So even with women who I've known for a while, sometimes we have to remember we're not who we're reaching, and or we're not who we're reaching for.
I think sometimes that having the awareness of who actually is my student base and what can I realistically expect from them allows us to reframe what training we give them. Because as you say, I mean, the average student who, and I probably need to preface this by saying, I'm talking more of the people that are looking for self-protection, not people that are looking for martial arts. Like martial arts, if it's framed that way, there's a chance you're going to get that person who really is looking for the lifetime pursuit, like someone who's really looking for that hobby that lets them blow off some steam, and they're going to come 3 days a week and they're going to do it indefinitely. Someone who's looking often because of a fear or a worry or an anxiety to look to protect themselves, typically that student isn't going to be around for a long time. Because I mean, obviously if you're doing your job well, then they should become less fearful. And therefore, if that was their motivation, then they're probably not going to stick around. And that's a good thing, right? You should aim to get that student back out the door, cure their fears, keep in touch with them. Hopefully they're good to go on their own after a while. But if we frame that up and say, well, you know, I might get 10 sessions with this person. What am I going to teach them in 10 sessions? Mm-hmm. And too often, I think those of us that have come from the more traditional backgrounds, where we are used to going, no, if you're not going to train 6 hours a week for the next 10 years, then I can't work with you because that's not realistic. We actually need to frame the conversation and go, okay, that would be ideal. But if this is what I've got and I have this window of opportunity, I've got 10 hours to change this person's life, what information would I give them in that 10 hours? And I think when you frame it that way, rather than it can't be done, to if it could be done, what would it look like? Then you can start to think more creatively and you can start, and this is exactly what I do now. I mean, most of what I teach now is the before the fight, not during the fight. It's about mm-hmm. the situational awareness, the de-escalation skills, the processing people around you, all that kind of stuff. Because to me, that is what I deal with the most. I'm dealing with people that I'm going to have a single intervention with. So how can I give them some skills that they can apply? They don't have to do a lot of reps with to absorb. And I think I want to sort of lead into what you're doing with 500 Rising. To ask you, what are the skills that you think that most people need to know? And I mean, you're trying to build an army of instructors, right? You're trying to build this 500 that are going to go out there and change the world. So what are the things that you are teaching them that I guess to scale infinitely to be able to reach more people?
That is the driving question. That is why it took 2 years to get from point of like, hey, maybe we should do something, to actually being launching and moving out into the world with it, because it's not an easy question to answer, right? When we distill down all our years of training, and if we're just going to get down to, I have 10 hours with you, what do I teach? So our focus is on just listening to you, same thing, prevention, situational awareness, threat assessment, understanding the world around you, understanding where you go and what you do, and what the tenor of that place and space will be. And not from the standpoint of therefore don't go there. So Randy, you were talking about having interviewed him. He's a good friend of mine. And he was texting me a couple of weeks ago about a conversation he was having with he's very prolific on social media. I am not, but I'm working on it. And it was a social media driven conversation about somebody posted a blog or something about people in the like modeling industry and the high risk that goes with all of that when it comes to violating boundaries and sexual violence. And somebody posted a comment like, well, then why not just do something else? Pick a different profession. And I think that one of our goals on that situational awareness, threat assessment for prevention, et cetera, side of the house is to invert that conversation, because that's too much of the message already for women and girls in our culture is be safe, as opposed to go out there, be brave, be smart, be brave, but be smart, right? It's like, be safe. And so if this is seen as a high-risk profession, go pick something else, you know, instead of, you know, equipping. So it's a really common message in the culture, I think, at large. And so we want to take that whole big chunk, what we call prevention, which is all those, it's a robust curriculum, and have it be from a message of, with these skills, you can go out there and, you know, make the world happen. Like whatever it is that you want to do, use these skills to do that versus use these skills to not be afraid. And although that's certainly part of it is if I have been afraid, now I know how to manage that. But that the message we want to avoid a message of this is about managing fear. And this is about getting out there and being bold in life. And then on the physical side, I have tiny little bits of various other martial arts, because I was like, did something for a while. I don't like that. Did something else, you know, Krav Maga, stuck with it. And that's an important point of reference, because there are a whole lot of physical skills out there in the universe that I'm sure are fantastic that I have never even seen. So we don't want to create a binding curriculum with 500. So what we've done is our physical skills training is all principle based. And so based on things like, you know, center of gravity to base and therefore balance and structure and how the skeleton works and how you can use it to your advantage and how it can be used to your disadvantage and exploiting gravity and just all of the things that go into the reality of bodies moving in space and bodies interacting in space and addressing the primary types of violence that women experience through a principle-based perspective. So in an instructor training, we spend a lot of time with, okay, here's the problem. Here are the solutions I like. And I'm not the end all for sure. And these are the principles though that make them work, which is why I like them. Now go play. Yep. And we cut them loose and they start rolling and screwing around with it and trying different things. And I have more struggle, I think, with my traditional martial artists who are coming through the training than I do with the people who are kind of just a corrections officer who's just coming in based on the training that they have underneath their belt, because the traditionalists want to know the technique, you know, 45 degree angle, you know, where do I put, is it, you know, the fingers are this way, or, you know, how's the fist structured? And not that any of that is bad and wrong. I love that stuff, but back to our conversation about women and not training for long periods of time, we need to be able to look at things and go, the physics are like this, and the physics are what make this thing work. And then as an instructor, if you've got stuff you like that I've never seen before and you think is highly applicable to women's self-defense, and this is kind of that third tier of what we're about, here is a list. It's a 4-page document. I'm trying to make it shorter, but right now that's as short as I've gotten it, of how to assess your techniques against the realities of violence and women's self-defense. And if that skill, like you really want to teach X when you teach women's self-defense, and it's not something that, you know, we have through 500 Rising, go through this checklist. And if it passes, have at it. And then that checklist again is based on the physics, especially with the size differentials, and then also some of those realities of violence and how things are actually going to go down versus how we like to pretend we're John Wick. And,
you know. I love that. I really love that approach. I just want to go back to something you said at the start there about encouraging people not to just go, well, that's unsafe, therefore I'm not going to do it. Well, that's a higher risk, therefore I'm not going to do it. Because this is it's a conversation that's very close to my heart. So I have four daughters, right? So my instinctive urge is protection and don't take unnecessary risk. But professionally, I'm a risk manager, right? So I manage risk all the time in all sorts of different areas. And I recognize that risk is also opportunity, right? Risk is threat, but it's also opportunity. So I would never tell a client, don't take risks. Like that's not something I would do because then they can't do business. So what you say there just struck a chord with me because I use this analogy frequently. Like if I had a young male who wanted to do a job that was working at heights around electricity, for example, like we recognize that's a high risk occupation. Like we know from a safety point of view, that's a high risk occupation. No one says, well, maybe we shouldn't have line workers. Like, because we need them, right? These people need to do jobs. So what do? We mitigate the risk as best we possibly can. Okay. We provide them the training, we provide them the PPE. We put all sorts of safety mechanisms in place so that they can do that job as safely as possible. And yet when we have a young lady wanting to travel or wanting to do something that is higher risk than staying home in a bubble, our immediate reaction is maybe you shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, maybe you should just deprive yourself of your happiness and the things that you want to do so that you don't accidentally come across someone who might want to do you harm, as opposed to let's give you the skills so that if you meet that person, one, you'll recognize them from a distance before they even know that you're there. And two, if you do find yourself in conversation or in a situation with this person, that you've got some skills to at least get to safety. And then, as you said, then you can be bold, right? Because then you feel like you've got a level of defensibility and you're not as vulnerable as you were. And you can then go out and really do what does make you happy. And you don't know what you're empowering someone to achieve when you give them that sense of confidence to go do something, as opposed to having to continually assess whether this is the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, the risk management from the perspective of holding, like restraining and holding back is basically a scared rabbit syndrome approach. Like I need to live hypervigilant versus aware. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that doesn't do anybody any good either, but it is interesting that we do have that. And I had a sister and then I had boys. So the universe was like, we're going to throw you a complete curveball. and it is interesting to compare the conversations of like looking at this is with our boys, how we raise them. Like, oh, you want to do that? Give it a shot. You want to do that? Give it a shot. And even personally, I've had to stop and wonder once in a while, if I'd had a daughter and that had been the request, would I have been quite so like, you know, I grew up in the same socialization, you know, matrix as everybody else did. So I'm certainly not immune. And it's a conversation we have to, I think, consciously realize is we're marinating in it, you know? And so we have to consciously manage that.
And look, and I think from a male's point of view, like it can be really, and I assume it's the same from a female point of view, but I won't make that assumption because I don't know. From a male's point of view, it's sometimes hard for us to remember that we actually live in different worlds. Like the sense making that goes on around us is completely different depending on how you've been raised, depending on what environment you've been in, whether you've been empowered or sheltered, and all these kinds of different variables. Whether you've learned to trust people or be fearful of people, like all these things. I mean, everyone is different. And I think broadly speaking, it's a very different world for women than it is for men. And we have different concerns and different things that we process on a regular basis. And sometimes when we try to apply our standards to someone who lives a very different life or has lived a very different experience to us, we get this disconnect and frustration. But why aren't you doing it the way that I think you should do it? Because that's just not their reality. They're working with different parameters to us. So yeah, I mean, look, we're just ranting now, but I'm with you.
Well, and it goes the other direction too. So 100%. One of the things I sort of a failing up moment, I was, Randy and I had developed a workshop that we did a test run up at his place in Canada, and then COVID and we never did it again. So but we were taking his specialty and expertise in social violence and mine in asocial. And we put together this little 2-day workshop, and I had, you know, we all have our blind spots and our biases. And I've been working with this material, especially around the context of sexual violence and sexual assault for forever. And I was using him as my demo partner to, you know, work through something and then show them like, okay, now go play with this, find your own solution. And it's one of the darker contexts. People don't like to talk about different circumstances of rape scenarios. So in this one, we were dealing with face down. So she's face down and he's behind her, she's on the ground. And I was trying, and you've met Randy, so to speak, right? He's not a small human being. And I'm about 5'3". So I'm expecting like more weight, more pressure, more, you know, and I'm like, Randy, like, dude, come on. Like, he's like, where are you? And we were running short on time. And so in my like rapid pace of frustration, of like, oh, we got to get this done so they can go play, I kicked him off and I wouldn't even look at him. I'm like, go away, you're being too nice. And pulled one of his female students who I know. And I was, and her name's Heidi. I was like, Heidi, come here. And she was like, I know exactly what to do, right? So she's up there and, you know, driving pressure. And then we were able to talk through the physics and then send off to play. What I had, because I was, don't have eyes in the back of my head, what I could not see was, and Randy talks about this, so I don't think it's a problem that I'm sharing it here, his personal struggle in front of largely his students and clients playing a very horrific role and in the minds of most people. And I'm like, what is wrong with you? Come on, like, more pressure, dude, let's go. And he's going, I don't want to be this person.
Yeah.
And I didn't even think about it. And so in processing that afterwards, it's something now that we add into the instructional training with 500 is like, that's, as women, true. we need to also pay attention to our guys. We just, you know, we grab them to demonstrate something and they're here because they're the good guys. And we're putting them through a grinder emotionally. And we need to stop and pay attention and be mindful of them as well. So, and so it kind of that awareness of people live in different worlds is important for women to think of as well, especially if they use the gentlemen as demo partners.
Yeah, it's, I love that you mentioned that because it is a real struggle. And I had the fortune of training under Meredith Gold and Mike Belzer from Raw Power Women's Self-Defense in LA. And they have a whole program of what they call mugger training, where they train bad guys basically to be good role players. And it's really interesting some of the things that they've addressed with that training. But I know when I was basically a one man show and I was doing all the scenarios and I was doing, you know, getting in the red man suit and doing all the bad guy stuff. Like when you've done 4, 5, 6 of these real intense role plays in a row, like you are shot, like you are done, not physically, just emotionally. Yeah. I remember role playing with students, like you need to get them emotionally activated sometimes. Like you need to sort of wake them up and get them into a scenario that feels real. And if it's just give me your wallet at the ATM, like that's, it doesn't do anything necessarily. So I remember distinctly there's one scenario where I was playing a pedophile trying to separate this guy from his kids, right? And it was just the most horrifically taxing thing to try and access this dark part, not even of my personality, but like a media / research informed personality, and trying to get to that and to make it believable is, man, that's rough. But I love the cognizant of that. One thing I want to get to just before we finish up the main interview, because it is something that I've seen a number of my female colleagues share on social media over the last week or so. And you may have even started it, I'm not sure. I've seen it come from a few places. But just this idea that women's self-defense is inherently different because most of the time women are defending themselves against someone they know. It's someone that they're in a relationship with. that they have emotional baggage with. They might justify their actions because they know the person's backstory. And they also have to appreciate that if whatever intervention they take to protect themselves, there is going to be consequences that follow on from this. Unless that person dies, there is going to be more consequences afterwards. So how do you unpack that? I mean, let's explain that. I mean, my audience is 95% male, as far as I'm aware. So maybe it's shifted a little bit. Maybe it's about 85% now, but it's still predominantly male. So for those that may not get that, do you just want to riff on that just for a minute about what those realities are?
Sure. So depending on who you access for your statistics, that we have a big range, but it's still a very robust range. So it starts at like 70% and goes up to 85 to 95, depending on whose numbers you're looking at. So if we're going to be generous here, we'll be say between 70 and 90% of actions of violence against women are engaged by somebody that she knows. So they're perpetrated by a known individual to her. Some of those numbers get distilled into intimate partner relationship, to just somebody's friend, to, you know, so that's where the numbers start to get wishy-washy as far as who's what. But that is the dominant, by and far, not 51%, but like 70 and up, of violence against women is perpetrated by somebody known to her. And why that's so essential in any conversation of women's self-defense or threat assessment, that whole package, is that when she's looking at this individual who's functioning in a threatening behavior pattern, she has a large context for who this person is, and therefore a large context driving a very complex decision tree now. Is it domestic violence? Is this her partner? What happens if she fights back? Usually doesn't end well. And then, or calls the police. And in some places in the United States, it's mandatory removal, whether she presses charges or not. And so she calls the police, they take him, he comes back. Now what? And, you know, so, and then if we fall outside of that and we just look at, I shouldn't say just to minimize this, if we look at social groups and we have a young woman or a woman and her best friend's boyfriend's, you know, office mate is the one who's pushing these advances and violating the boundaries. And if she sets a hard boundary, that's a crew of people that hangs out together all the time. And the ripple effect within the social network is not insignificant. And she's thinking about that as she's making these decisions. It's not just, I'm going to kick your ass. It's all of the impact that goes into it and all of the deep social programming that goes into women are kind, they're nurturing, they're the community builders, not the community shatterers, right? So it has a huge influence on what it's going to take for her to find that anchor from which she can move confidently in either setting a hard boundary or if she has the physical skills and it's going physical, even if she doesn't have the physical skills, it's not hard to hurt another human being if you need to, right? So if it's going to go physical and she needs to respond, where she finds that gravitas from which to do that is hanging out in this churning sea of all of this other information. And when I have this conversation around particularly traditional male martial artists, they're like, well, why doesn't she just? And it's like, I get it. And that is never going to be the reality. So it's like you said early on, we are wired a bit differently across the gender spectrum. And she's going to be thinking about all those things and the consequences and the aftermath that goes with it. Even a hard boundary set in a corporate setting, for example, somebody who's doing that, what Anna Valdeseri writes about, the low-level creeper who's, you know, fishing right around the edges and he knows just what line not to cross so he doesn't get hooked into HR and fired. If she sets a boundary with him, he's going to go office chatter to other people and that could authentically impact her next promotion.
Absolutely.
So it's, right, and so we go, oh, that shouldn't matter, but putting food on the table matters. So we can't just dismiss those things.
Yeah, it's is so much more complex. I mean, that's the whole point of this show, right? Like, I haven't got to 93 episodes because violence is an easy subject. It's so much more complex. And one thing I've found that has helped sort of open eyes occasionally when I've had a male instructor or student who is kind of struggling with this idea that it's different. Let's talk about something like that's a drill that we do on a regular basis. Like, we've got a knife attack and we're going to do knife defense and we're going to do like, and if you look at it purely from a combative point of view, like the principles are pretty simple. Don't let the pointy thing inside you. Like, isolate the weapon, destroy the threat, escape, right? Those principles are fairly universal. There's differences of opinion about which order you do things in, but whatever, right? The principles are pretty much the same. Don't get stabbed, yeah. Hurt the bad guy, get away. But that's fine. And we can drill it. And then I remember asking this student who was really struggling with it. I said, you know, like you're doing the physical skills well, and he couldn't understand why this wouldn't apply in for women. And I said, well, would you have done the same thing if this was your adult son with mental health issues and a drug dependency who's trying to hold you up for money because he's trying to get a score and like he's just at a really bad place? Would you still crush his trachea? And like, so, well, no, because, well, why wouldn't you do that? I mean, the threat's the same. So, because it's my son and I love him. And okay, so imagine that you're in an intimate relationship with somebody and you have built these justifications for their behavior, and you know about the trauma they've been through, and you know about the struggles they have, and you know that 85% of the time they're a good guy, right? You're asking that same, it might not be a knife attack, but we're still dealing with a physical threat, and you expect her to just gouge his eyes out and maim him for life and then put him in jail. So if you actually care about someone, you love someone, those are big decisions to make, right? And sometimes it's easier for us to justify going through the trauma ourselves or going through the injury or the discomfort ourselves than it is to actually inflict the consequences upon someone that we have decided to love or that we've built up this relationship and connection with.
You know, and I wonder, this is just a wondering, I have no hard data to support it. I wonder if, is a male looking at that circumstance and that natural tendency to say, why doesn't she just?
Yep.
It comes from almost a displacement. So it is uncomfortable to pause and think about the prevalency. It's uncomfortable to pause and think about somebody who's supposed to love her and, you know, be a partner with her is beating the shit out of her. It's uncomfortable to think about that, to the depth that allows us to contact the reality of it. So I think there's this deflection of like, well, just
do
this. Like,
let's just remove the emotion and make it a physical problem. Mm-hmm. But then right. we're negating like 90% of the violence is the emotion. Right? Yeah. So yeah.
And I think that's one of the struggles in the self-defense industry is, and I say struggle because I feel the industry struggling to fix this, right? To find a way to address it, is that traditionally, women's self-defense has been taught from that stranger danger context of how to have your head on a swivel in the parking garage. You know, well, that's not where your intimate partner is not hiding behind the pillar to jump out at you. That's such a small percentage. It certainly happens, but that stranger predicated violence is a tiny fraction of the reality of violence. And yet,
but it's easy to talk about.
It's easier to talk about and it's easier to teach. And so that's what women's self-defense seminars have dominantly addressed as long as I've been in the industry. And that's where there's that disconnect of like, we're not, you know, we're hitting 15% of the problem. Why are we doing that?
And that there's no cut and dry answer, right? I mean, we can teach.
That's true.
Like, I mean, I've taught these sort of sessions before where we're looking at red flags of behaviors in the dating or courtship phase where you're like, oh, okay, that's going to be an issue. But then the reality is that there are going to be people that have red flags based upon their previous experiences or childhood traumas or all this kind of stuff. And I've actually just seen this conversation pop up on a Facebook group I'm part of, which isn't self-defense related at all. It's actually a parenting group. And it was actually from the opposite end where a father was saying, yeah, my son is 17 years old. He's got his first girlfriend, but she's got all these flags of mental illness and unpredictable behaviors, but he loves her and his grades are tanking and he's doing all this stuff because he's in love with her, but we think she's unstable and a bad influence. Mm-hmm. And her parents are lovely, but she's got issues, right? And the advice is so different because people are like saying, no, you need to put your foot down. Like, don't let him tank his future over this girl. But it's like, she's a human being who deserves to be loved as well, right? So, I mean, if she's got issues, it doesn't mean they're permanent. She's a teenage girl. Like my experience is that nearly everyone's going to have issues at some point. So
pretty much.
Yeah. And it depends on your perspective as a parent as to how, like, I'm gathering this father wasn't a psychotherapist. He wasn't actually able to diagnose anything, just thought she was a bit off. So, I mean, we can say, look for red flags, but then people are like, well, yeah, there's flags, but they're a nice person and I believe in their heart and they can change and they can. So even if you give people education, it's still about the application of that education and understanding that human beings will usually make an emotional decision and then justify it later. You know, we're not rational creatures, we're rationalizing creatures. So it's not easy to say, just do this, because this won't always work and it won't always make people feel good. So it's a look,
100%.
By way of closing out, this is a question I normally include in the bonus questions, but I think given what you do, it's important to sort of give you a platform to sort of address this. As I said, most of my audience is male. I don't know exactly what the percentages are anymore because hopefully we've tried to shift that to be more inclusive and get more people involved. But for the male instructors out there that are maybe trying to do the right thing when it comes to teaching women self-defense, and this is for women instructors as well, because most women instructors were trained by men. So not all of them are doing it as well as they possibly could, right? So what would you say are probably like, if you had to give like three pieces of advice about how to teach proper women self-defense or to really help women with that self-protection challenge, what are the three main things that you would say, do this or don't do this?
The first thing is mindset and attitude more than anything else. And that is to work from an assumption of strength. So wherever she's at, wherever she's been, whatever she's been through, even if she's struggling, so the trauma is relatively fresh, she is hitting your mat or your training session from a place of strength. And then our job is to take them from whatever that place of strength is to the next place, rather than the mindset of fragile, broken, you know, kid gloves kind of a thing.
I love that. I've never heard anyone say that before, but that's so good. I'm taking that.
You're welcome to. It is. It's kind of our tagline for 500 Rising, from strength to strength, because that's the big thing. And from a mindset and an attitude perspective, like, we teach from where we're at. Right. And so if we carry that in, it's going to shift everything that we do with our female students. And I was one of those women, trust me, when I first started teaching Krav Maga, I was walking around like the guy on the mat, which is kind of stupid because I'm 5'3", you know, and some of my instructors who were large human beings would laugh at me and walk up and go, you know, you're not 6 feet tall. You are aware of that, right? Like, just so you know, you might want to think about acting like you're 5'3". So I think that's the big one. And then the second one is recognizing that women who train because they love it are in it for the long haul. Mm. If you're teaching self-defense, you're going to draw women who are coming for that bit of information to move on. So teach in a way that allows them to take what they've learned and apply it to things they've never seen before.
Mm, I love that. That's really good.
And that's why what we're doing is like principles. Because if you get how all our bodies are put together pretty much the same way, and if you get how bodies work, when that problem hits you that you've never seen before, you have something from which to solve it, right? Mm. You know, solve the problem you have, not the one you wish you had.
And that's a great quote. That's it's all the problem you have, not the one you wish you had. I could apply that to so many different contexts. That's great.
And then, I don't know, those are the two big ones. And teach whatever you want to call them, soft skills, alpha skills, everything that goes in that prevention side of the house, make that dominant information, because, and I could be completely wrong about this, but my gut tells me that when we teach women self-defense and it's all the physical stuff, because, and that's what people think, and that's what women think they're supposed to get. So there's expectation management in there as well. What we're telling women is you are / will be at some point in time a victim of violence. So all we're going to give you is the response to the violence, i.e. the violent response. You don't have any power to do anything about it until it's right here. And that's the message that I think subliminally comes across when we do a women's self-defense seminar and it's all hitting, kicking, punching, you know, gouging eyes and, you know, throat punch and whatever. We're saying you have to wait until it's here. So teach the soft skills or alpha skills or whatever you want to call them. That would be the third thing. Make that a dominant part of your curriculum.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think so. Sometimes the struggle for instructors with that is like, well, people are paying to come and hit pads. It's like, no, well, right. Are they or are they not? And really understanding, like, if you have a student who's literally just coming because it's their stress relief and they just want to hit pads and they just want to have fun, cool, do those classes. But especially if you're a full-time instructor and you have the luxury of being able to set your own timetable, then make sure you're including those other classes as an option for those that want to do it, or do some webinars, or give some reading materials, or make a reading list,
yep.
Like whatever it is that's going to allow you to be able to touch on that base. Just because maybe 80% of your students don't care doesn't mean that you shouldn't provide that for the 20% who need it.
And it's not hard. You can, on an ongoing curriculum, you can pepper little things in. Yes. And we've gotten to, like, our first rank test at the gym we have here in Northern Virginia includes, like, while you're hitting, kicking, punching, and, you know, doing choke defenses, I'm going to pull you up in pairs and I'm going to ask you some questions. What's the highest order win in self-defense? Like, what's, you know, what are the four, you know, the four things that are present in every violent encounter? That's part of your test now, sports fans.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so we can find ways to, like, it's the seasoning, because people want to hit, kick, and punch. Okay, cool. No problem. If you know the material, you know how violence works, you've done the homework, you've done the research, it can take you 15 seconds on a break while they're catching their breath to put that one little statement in there, you know, like it tucking it in.
Yeah. And look, if you don't have that knowledge, one, you're listening to this podcast, so you're probably actively pursuing the knowledge anyway. But don't be afraid to call in a guest instructor to do a seminar, to do a workshop, to unpack, you know, criminal psychology or whatever it is that's going to work for your students, because people do find value in that. And there are a lot of people out there that are happy to provide that very reasonably. I mean, it's something that you shouldn't feel like if you're a seventh degree black belt in karate, it doesn't mean you have to be a psychotherapist as well, right? You can
100%.
Like, you want to, like, there are people like Tammy, yeah, like myself, like others we've had on the show that will come in and do a guest spot on a subject if that's something that you should do. So, Tammy, look, I know you're going to stick around and do the bonus round content, but for those that might be leaving us here, if they want to find out more about you and 500 Rising, what's the best way to connect with you and find out more information?
There are a couple of ways. I'm getting better at social media, famous last words, but I'm trying. I have 500 Rising has its own website, so 500rising.com. There's an opt-in form you can fill out. It's a little free ebook that comes with it, and that puts you on our mailing list if you're interested in email. But we have a formal business Facebook page. We have a 500 Rising community page, which is gated. So you have to say, hey, I want to join. Answer the questions. If you don't, I won't let you in. I have people go, you haven't let me in yet to answer the questions. And Instagram, 500 Rising has an Instagram account. And so if you want to find us, you can find us. And you can private message me through Facebook. You can find me on Facebook, Tammy Yard McCracken. And yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us, Tammy. It's been a fun conversation, and I'm sure lots of people will get some value out of it. So thank you for making yourself available.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun to talk to you.
Thank you once again to Tammy Yard McCracken. What a fantastic conversation and a fantastic initiative. And Tammy and I have spoken offline after this interview, and the Managing Violence podcast stands firmly behind 500 Rising. So anything we can do to help them with their cause is obviously near and dear to my heart as a dad of four daughters. The more strong women that we have protecting other strong women, then the better the world is. So make sure you go to 500rising.com, follow them on social media, support the cause. It's something that really has the potential to be a game changer. So make sure you check them out. Now, if you'd like to support the podcast, make sure you head on over to patreon.com/managingviolence. Check out our website at violencepod.com. There is merch available. We have t-shirts, we have mugs, we have all sorts of cool stuff. If you want to support the show that way, you can. Or if you just want to throw us some bucks and say thanks for the content, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/JoeMVP. Other than that, that will do us for this week. I'll talk to you next time.